This sutta tonight is called the Greater Series of Questions and Answers. It goes quite deep. So I hope you understand. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathan Pindika's Park. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Mahakohita rose from meditation, went to the Venerable Sariputta, and exchanged greetings to him. He didn't go alone. He went with his students, and Sariputta was sitting with some students. So that's why these questions. Mahakohita was an arahat. He already knew the answers, but he was asking the questions for his students. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Venerable Sariputta, One who is unwise is said, friend, with reference to what was this said, one who is unwise. One does not wisely understand. One does not wisely understand. That is why it is said, one who is unwise. And what doesn't one wisely understand? One doesn't wisely understand this is suffering. Now, he's actually talking about the links of dependent origination. Okay. One does not wisely understand this is the origin of suffering. One does not wisely understand this is a cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand. One does not wisely understand, friend. That is why it is said, one who is unwise. Saying, good friend, the Venerable Mahakohita delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then he asked him a further question. One who is wise is said, friend, with reference to what was this said, one who is wise. So basically what he's asking is when you're wise or when you're unwise, you don't understand the links of dependent origination that have the Four Noble Truths in each link. And the three characteristics. And this is a big push with a lot of people that are practicing other forms of meditation. They make an emphasis of impermanence, suffering, not self. But in each link, you will see this for yourself. So when we're talking about the links of dependent origination, we're also talking about the Four Noble Truths and the three characteristics. It's all interconnected and combined. One wisely understands, friend, that is why it is said, one who is wise. What does one wisely understand? One wisely understands this is suffering. One wisely understands this is the cause of suffering, or the origin of suffering. One wisely understands this is the cessation of suffering. One wisely understands this is a way leading to the cessation of suffering. One wisely understands, friend, that is why it is said, one who is wise. consciousness. Consciousness is said, friend, with reference to what is consciousness said. It cognizes. It cognizes, friend. That is why consciousness is said. What does it cognize? Well, cognize is an interesting word, and its meaning is seeing in the present. Okay? When you recognize or recognize, that means you're going into your memory to think to things that have already happened. But when you cognize, that means you're seeing it directly in the present, whatever it happens to be. It cognizes this is pleasant. It cognizes this is painful. It cognizes this is neither painful nor pleasant. It cognizes, friend. That is why consciousness is said. Wisdom and consciousness, friend, are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them? Wisdom and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. For what one wisely understands, that one cognizes. And what one cognizes, that one wisely understands. Again, we're talking about the links of dependent origination. And when you see it, you wisely understand what it is. Right? That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. What is the difference, friend, between wisdom and consciousness, these states that are conjoined, not disjoined? The difference, friend, between wisdom and consciousness, these states that are conjoined, not disjoined, is this. Wisdom is to be developed. So you develop the ability to see the links. Consciousness is to be fully understood. So you fully understand the links when you see them for yourself. So you have to develop the ability to start seeing the links and understand what you're seeing. Pretty straightforward. Feeling is said, friend, with reference to what is feeling said. It feels, friend. That is why feeling is said. What does it feel? It feels pleasure, it feels pain, it feels neither pain nor pleasure. It feels, friend. That's why feeling is said. Perception is said, friend, with reference to what is perception said. It perceives, friend. That's why perception is said. What does it perceive? It perceives blue. It perceives yellow. It perceives red. It perceives white. Now, perception is the very start of conceptual thinking. What is blue? It's a concept, right? It's made up of other things, but we call it, this is blue. Every thought you have is a concept. That's why learning how to translate is so tricky, because there's all different kinds of concepts with words. When you experience Nibbana, another definition of this experience is no more concepts. So you're going beyond just thinking mind. You're going on beyond conceptual ideas. And it would be a relief to have that, right? That's why perception is said. Feeling, perception, and consciousness, friends. Are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them? Feeling, perception, and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it is impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. For what one feels, that one perceives. And what one perceives, that one cognizes. Okay, so this is kind of an interesting thing, because you have the five aggregates, right? You have body, feeling, perception, formations, and mind. So the five aggregates are actually three aggregates, because feeling, perception, and consciousness are conjoined. You can't separate them. So it's just another way of describing things. I think this has caused a lot of confusion with some of the translations of the text. Now, you always hear me say, when I'm talking about the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, in the translation it just says perception and feeling. But there has to be the cessation of consciousness too. And that's what the cessation of suffering is all about. When you experience they call it in Pali, Nirodha Samapatti. That means the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. That's a blackout that happens. You don't know you're in it until you come back out and reflect on seeing what it was. Interesting state to be in. Now, if for the first two stages of awakening, these will happen by themselves, but it'll only be for a short period of time. When you get to be an anagami, your understanding of how the links of dependent origination is very much stronger. And you can make a determination that you want to experience the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. And you can do that for as long as you want, up to 7 days. Now, I have some students in Indonesia that they started experimenting with the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. And they wanted to see what it was like to do it for a short period of time, just to see if they could do it, and see what happened when they got back out of it. So they would make a determination to sit in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness for 20 minutes. And they would do that especially when they were tired. And they would come out of that state and they were very energetic and very happy. But the thing with this is you have to make a determination on the amount of time you're going to be in this. If you try to sit more than 7 days, the six sense doors, the vitality and heat, dissipate, and the body dies. When the body dies, then there is no more of that person. They will be reborn in another realm. They'll die from the human realm. So it's kind of interesting that in some circles with the Theravada monks, they say that the only time you can experience the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness is when you're either an anagami or an arahat. But you experience it in the lower stages, but you don't have control over it. It just happens. It's going to stay as long as it's going to stay, and then your consciousness comes back. But when you get to be an anagami, you can sit for up to 7 days. That means no bathroom breaks. That means no eating. That means no interruption. And there is no consciousness, but there is still body functions. You still have breath, you still have heartbeat, but they're very much reduced. Now, I had one teacher that could do this and sit up to 7 days. And it really sounds neat. It sounds like a good thing. Okay, let's do that, you know. And I said, well, why do you want to do that? And she gave me a one-word answer. Relief. Think about that. No sound is going to bother you. Nothing on the physical plane is going to bother you. For 7 days. No thoughts. What relief. And when they come out of that, they are absolutely radiant. You know, you see a lot of the pictures of different saints and such, like they have a halo around them. Well, that's what it looks like. Their face is really radiant and incredibly beautiful. So, what I suggest to anybody that's around somebody like that, when they come out of that state, give them something. Their mind is absolutely pure. And giving to someone that's very pure, you make a whole lot of merit. And that'll come back to you in all kinds of wonderful ways. So it's a real good thing. And the good qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, when he's talking about the Sangha, one of the statements that's made is they're worthy of gifts. Now, there's actually 10 kinds of Sangha. Okay. I know most of the time in America, you just hear about, well, there's the monk Sangha, and that means community, so all of the laymen can be Sangha too. Well, that's 2 kinds of Sangha. The other 8 kinds of Sangha are Sotapanna with fruition, Anagami with fruition, or Saktagami with fruition, Anagami with fruition, Arahat with fruition. These are the 8 kinds of individuals that are really worthy of gifts. So, these 10 different kinds of Sangha are reasonably different. And when you practice your generosity with that's what happens when I start getting tired. The noble Sangha is people that have had the experience and have become saints. That's the definition of a saint in Buddhism. Being a saint in other traditions means that they had to do some kind of thing and there had to be some kind of miracle in it. And then you have to wait for a few years to be claimed that you were a saint. Ledi Sayadaw in Burma, he was quite a remarkable scholar. And it was claimed while he was alive that this only happens, have somebody of his caliber of understanding intellectually about once every 100 years. And he said that the noble Sangha is what makes up the age of saints. And we're still in this age. We're in the age of saints. Ain't that neat? I mean, you hear about saints of all different kinds, and well, they were real special people too. But it's nothing quite like becoming a Sotapanna. I mean, you're not going to have more than 7 lifetimes before you get off the wheel of samsara. You're never going to be born in lower realms. The lowest realm you'll be reborn in is human being. And quite often, when the Sotapanna or Saktagami die, they're reborn in either a Brahmaloka or a Devaloka. Now, Devalokas are like the low heavens. You don't have to do any meditation to get into the Devaloka. You just have to be a really good person. And you have to, well, you practice your generosity and your compassion and keep your precepts. Now, there's six different devalokas. The first devaloka is called earthbound spirits. Okay. Now, one day in that devaloka is equivalent to 50 years for us. Now, the next one is where Saka lives, the king of the heaven of the 33. Now, these realms are very pleasurable. Beautiful sights, beautiful sounds, lots of singing, lots of partying. I think they do. They float around with them all the time. But one day in the Tavsatimsa heaven, that's the second realm, is equivalent to 100 years as a human being. And you live to be around 100 years. So it lasts for a long time. One of the things about being in the Devaloka, which is kind of an interesting phenomena, is that they have to eat something every day. And grapes appear to them. And so they're always munching on grapes. Or if they want to get out of that realm, they just stop eating and they will be reborn in another realm. I mean, the Bodhisattva, when he was reborn as in the Tavsatimsa heaven, he just spent a short time there because he wanted to come back in the human realm. But depending on his merit at the time and his past actions, he might be reborn as an animal. He might be reborn as a human being. He might be reborn again in another realm. So the next realm, I can't remember the name of it, lasts for, in human terms, one day there is equivalent to 200 years. Where the Bodhisattva Maitreya is in the Tusita heaven. One day there is equivalent to 400 years here. And he's going to be hanging around in that for quite a while before the conditions are right for him to arise again, or the Buddha to arise. Our Buddha was called an intelligent Buddha because when he took a bodhisattva vow, he became a Buddha pretty quickly. Four Mahakappas in 100,000 lifetimes. And that's considered quick. Now, a Mahakappa, one Mahakappa is considered to be, in human terms, 10 with 560 zeros behind it. That's how many years one Mahakappa is. So he's going to be reborn many, many, many times. Some of his rebirths are going to be very challenging. Some of them are not going to be so challenging. But for that whole period of time that he's a bodhisattva, he is working on perfecting what is called is parami. And that has to do with loving kindness. And when the bodhisattva became a bodhisattva, when he took that vow, he never lied in all of his lifetimes. And in doing that, he developed the truth and was perfect with his truth. That's one of the reasons why you read about the Buddha and he would have 5,000 people around him or more, and he would give a Dhamma talk. He never raised his voice so everybody could hear. They could hear it. But if you were outside this big mass of people, you wouldn't hear what he said. It only goes right to that last person that's listening. And when he said something, you knew that what he said was true. He wasn't trying to fool you. And his voice was very, very sweet to listen to. There's a bird in Asia that it's a little tiny yellow bird. I don't remember the name of it anymore. But this bird had a really big voice. And anytime you hear that bird, you stop and listen. Everybody does. And that's what the Buddha's voice was like. That's what it says. It was just so pleasing to the ear that it's like, oh, yeah, there he is, good one. And it makes you smile. So there's different kinds of Buddha. Okay, he was an intelligent Buddha. The next kind of Buddha, he works for 8 Mahakapas and 100,000 lifetimes. And he is called
energetic
Buddha. Now, he's reborn in a period of time when lifetimes for human beings starts to be longer. Because we all go through those kind of things. And he would only give a Dhamma talk maybe once a year, something like that. But he might live 10,000 years in human, the way we think of human time. The other kind of Buddha is called a moral Buddha. And it takes him 16 Mahakapas and 100,000 lifetimes. So we're talking about somebody that's really, really amazing. And he lives in a time when the lifetime of human beings is around 100,000 years. And he gives a Dhamma talk once every 100 years or so. But Gautama Buddha, and they all teach exactly the same thing. Okay? Gautama Buddha gave Dhamma talks quite often. And he was always traveling around talking and spreading the truth of existence and how it actually worked. Now, if he was going to teach the Dhamma like this, he affected around 60 million people in the world at that time. If he taught the way to become a sotapanna so you could become a saint, in a way that was complicated, hard to understand, and took a long time to understand it, he would not have been near as popular as he was. This is why when you look at the good qualities of the Dhamma, it says this is immediately effective. He couldn't teach somebody, yeah, you got to go 5 years before you really get it. They didn't have time for that. They were simple folks for the most part. They were not well educated. He had to teach them something that they could grasp very quickly and easily. Now, during the time as a Buddha, and even today, it can happen that you can become a Buddha, a Sotapanna, by listening to the Dhamma. And you listen attentively. It's not, you don't start thinking about something else, oh, I've heard this before. But you listen very attentively. And if your understanding is good, you can become a Sotapanna just by listening to the Dhamma. That happened a lot. That happened to Visakha, who later became the foremost supporter of the female supporter of the Sangha during the time of the Buddha. She built a castle for the monks to stay in. She fed monks continually. If they got sick, she had somebody taking care of them. She was always working for the Dhamma. Now, when she was 8 years old, her grandfather took her to listen to the Buddha, and she became a Sotapanna, 8 years old. Her understanding was good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, she really did. She was a very intelligent woman. And her heart was so pure that she didn't allow any kind of distractions, even at 8 years old. She just listened to what he said and understood it, became a Sotapanna right then. She stayed a Sotapanna for her whole life. Interesting thing, when she got married, she wound up having 20 children. 20. Oh, that's amazing. And she was just super generous, always giving. And she was so smart and so wise that some of the rules for the monks were her idea. They came from her, and the Buddha heard what she had to say and said, yes, that's right, let's put that in. Now, this idea that a lot of feminists have about Buddhism, about being equal and all of this sort of thing, they don't run across stories like this that show how the Buddha highly respected women. But there had to be a hierarchy the way that he had it set up. And there are some nuns in Sri Lanka that I highly respect because they're so interesting and they understand the Dhamma in a way that, and they can explain it in a way that's easy to grasp. So when they come in the room, even though they're a female, monks aren't supposed to get up for other people when they come in the room. I always stand for her. I always, well, there's more than one, actually. But I always rise for them and wait until they sit down. and then sit down. And it's an Asian thing about showing your respect that way. But I think it's nice. So that's why I do it. Okay. Let's read this one thing again. So you really start to get it in a deeper way. What one feels, that one perceives. The perception here is that's painful, that's pleasant, that's neither painful nor pleasant. And when that arises, you're cognizing it. You're seeing it. You're understanding it. That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it is impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. Now, here is a really interesting part of this sutta. This is called Knowable by Mind Alone. Friend, what can be known by purified mind consciousness? Released from the five faculties, that means your body, your eyes, your ears, your tongue, your nose, your body. Friend, by purified mind consciousness, released from the five faculties, the base of infinite space, with compassion. This can be known as infinite space with compassion, with the base of infinite consciousness with joy. Now, you hear me say, you don't have a body now. This is what I'm talking about. These five faculties, they only arise when there's contact. And contact means putting your attention on them. So when I tell you, you don't have a body, this is a mental realm. Don't put your attention on your body at all. Just stay with mind and your object of meditation. And the base of nothingness with equanimity. Friend, with what does one understand a state that can be known? When it's talking about the arupa jhana. Friend, one understands a state that can be known with the eye of wisdom. What is the eye of wisdom? It's seeing without you're cognizing, you're seeing for yourself how the links actually work, and you're seeing the impersonal nature. You're seeing with a mind that doesn't have distractions in it. You're cognizing in the present what is there. So when I say you don't have a body, what I'm trying to get across to you is your mindfulness is not quite strong enough, and you're letting your attention go to the body. You're not seeing it as it first arises, as this little movement or vibration. And as soon as you see that movement or vibration, relax. Now, a lot of you are in neither perception nor non-perception, and that's who I'm talking to right now. Okay. So when you are in that space where there's nothing, a lot of people want to call that void, but that's not quite it either. It's neither perception nor non-perception. And Your mind is exceptionally still, and there's no movement, there's no vibration at all. As you keep your interest in watching that, when something starts to arise, you'll see that movement of mind's attention right then and relax. Things still might arise after that, but you have let go of the craving. And that's what the meditation is about, letting go of craving. It's hard to keep interested when there's nothing to watch. And it's also kind of fun, because there's real relief in that. There's real, it's really quiet. And that's nice. One of my students in Indonesia, she sat every time she did a retreat with me, she would get into this state. And she'd sit, and there was no movement or vibration for a whole hour. And then she'd break her sitting. She'd get up and start moving around. Nothing's happening anyway. I got to go do this. I got to do that. I did everything I wanted. I wanted to get some duct tape and tape her down so she wouldn't move. And I scolded her, I begged with her, I did everything I could to get her to stop doing that. And in the third year, I finally came up with something that she understood. In Asia, making merit, practicing your generosity and wholesome nature is really important to them. So I finally said, you can't make any better merit on the physical plane than sitting in this peaceful mind without any movements in it. And finally, her want to make more merit made her start paying attention to that. And she was successful when she sat for 2.5 hours or something like that. Now, a lot of you, I suggest that you sit longer. And the reason that I suggest that is because you need the time of not having any disturbance so that you can see clearly when a little thing starts to arise. What is that little thing? It is a kind of distraction. It has some craving in it, so you have to relax into that. Let go of that craving. That's how you purify your mind. When your mind is pure enough, you will get to the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. That's the way it works. So developing the eye of wisdom means seeing everything is impersonal. Everything. Doesn't matter whether you're sitting in meditation or not. Everything is impersonal. Everything you see, every building, every floor, every ceiling, everything is impersonal. And seeing things impersonally means seeing things without craving. Friend, what is the purpose of wisdom? Interesting question. The purpose of wisdom, friend, is direct knowledge. Its purpose is full understanding. Its purpose is abandoning. Abandoning what? All craving, all disturbance. Okay, friend, how many conditions are there for the arising of right view? Friend, there are two conditions for the arising of right view: the voice of another and wise attention. Now, you people hear that and they say, "Ah, that's my voice." It's not. This is a voice of the Buddha. So you use wise attention when you hear and start to understand how the links of dependent origination work. These are the two conditions for the arising of right view. And the thing that makes the Buddha so brilliant, and I read it to you, was how he came up to understand the links of dependent origination. I mean, these are things that hadn't been thought of before for a long period of time. Friend, how many factors is right view assisted when it has deliverance of mind by path and deliverance of mind with path and fruition? When it has deliverance of mind by wisdom for its path, and deliverance of mind by wisdom for its path and fruition. Friend, right view is assisted by five factors. When it has deliverance of mind for its path, deliverance of mind for its path and fruition. When it has deliverance of mind by wisdom for its path, and deliverance of mind by wisdom for its path and fruition. Here, friend, right view is assisted by virtue, keeping your precepts, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. One of the interesting things that a lot of people don't know, when you go back and you look up either jhana or serenity in the index, and then you look up insight, and then you start comparing where they are in the suttas, you see that insight and jhana or serenity are very often mentioned in the same sentence. And it's kind of interesting to think of it that way. And one of the suttas, 149, it says that serenity or jhana practice and insight are yoked together. Now you think of an ox cart. Now, if you want to go in a straight line, those oxen have to be pulling equally hard. If one of the oxen is pulling a little bit too hard, then you're going to start going in circles. If the other one is pulling too hard, then you're going to go in circles the other way. In order to go in a straight line, you need to be pulling equally with serenity and insight. Now, a lot of people today, when they're talking with me about their practice, they're excuse me, they were having such magnificent, and they really were, magnificent insights. I mean, this was really a joyful day for me. So many people had these insights into how they were doing things and how they could see that now. And once they see how their attachment worked, they can let it go very easily. That's great. A real fun day. Right view assisted by these five factors, virtue, keeping your precept, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. These five factors has deliverance of mind for its path, deliverance of mind for its path and fruition. It has deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom for its path, and deliverance by wisdom for its path and fruition. Friend, there are many kinds of being. How many kinds of being are there? Friend, there are three kinds of being, friend. Sense sphere being, fine material being, that means jhana, but the rupa jhanas, the first four jhanas, and the immaterial being. Another thing that a lot of people don't realize, because we don't talk about it this way very often, is that when in the suttas, when it's describing sama-samadhi, it just talks about four jhanas. The first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. But what a lot of people don't realize is the fourth jhana has four different aspects to it, and that's what the arupa jhanas are. When you get to the fourth jhana, you have equanimity. And then that equanimity starts to get stronger, and there's more peace and calm, and then you experience infinite space. And as you keep going, the equanimity starts getting stronger and stronger until you get to the realm of nothingness. And that's when you use equanimity as your object of meditation. And then you get into that neither awake but aware, You get into the state of like being asleep and being aware at the same time. Now the reason that you don't talk about the equanimity in this state is because mind is so subtle that you're not really able to see it or feel it. Neither perception nor non-perception is like it says in one of the suttas, if you're going to have an attachment, this is the highest and best attachment you can have. That's what Ananda said to the Buddha, and the Buddha agreed. He said, yeah, this is right. If you want to be attached to neither perception nor non-perception. And if you don't, keep using your six R's when there's a little tiny movement, then you'll go beyond that. Friend, how is renewal of being in the future generated? Friend, renewal of being in the future is generated through the delighting in this and that on the part of beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Okay, so what are we saying here? You don't understand the Four Noble Truths, and you're caught up in not seeing and recognizing what craving is, so you can let it go. That's what the six R's are all about. Friend, how is renewal of being in the future not generated? Friend, with the fading away of ignorance, with the arising of true knowledge, with the cessation of craving, renewal of being in the future is not generated. Getting off the wheel of samsara is a good thing. So then you will not have ever again any suffering. I think that's worth it. Okay, now we're going to talk a little bit about the first jhana. Friend, what is the first jhana? Here, friend, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. A monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought, with joy and happiness born of seclusion. This is called the first jhana. Friend, how many factors does the first jhana have? Friend, the first jhana has five factors. Here, when a person has entered the first jhana, there occur thinking, examining thought, happiness, joy, and unification of mind. That is how the first jhana has five factors. Friend, how many factors are abandoned in the first jhana? And how many factors are possessed? Friend, in the first jhana, five factors are abandoned, and five factors are possessed. Here, when a monk has entered upon the first jhana, sensual desire is abandoned, ill will is abandoned, sloth and torpor are abandoned, restlessness and anxiety are abandoned, and doubt is abandoned. So what are we saying? When you're in the jhana, you don't have a hindrance arising. But when your mindfulness gets weak for whatever reason, and you get distracted a little bit, guess who comes to dinner? One of the hindrances is going to arise. So what I try to get you to do is stay with your object of meditation for as long as you can. And when your mindfulness gets weak, you're not in the jhana anymore. Now you have a hindrance that you get to work with. Okay? And hindrances are good. They're not bad. They help you to develop your mindfulness. Sometimes it's hard to let go of the hindrances. They keep coming back. Okay. No problem. When your mind gets pulled away again, then relax. That hindrance is helping you so that your mindfulness can get stronger. So your observation of how this process works grows. And then when it gets strong enough, then you get into the next jhana. So the hindrances occur in between every jhana, whether it's rupa jhana or arupa jhana. Distractions happen. So you're knocked out of the jhana, then you get to practice your 6 hours. Ah, but the 6 hours don't work. They do work. But you have to use all 6 hours. It's not just release, relax, release, relax, release, relax. That doesn't work. Guaranteed. You have to do the whole formula. Bringing up something wholesome. Smile. I don't feel like smiling. Don't care. Smile anyway. Bring that light, clear mind back to your object of meditation. Simple, right? Not always easy, but simple. Okay, so these are the things that are abandoned, and there occur thinking, examining thought, joy, happiness, and unification of mind. This is how in the first jhana, five factors are abandoned and five factors are possessed. Now we get to talk about the five faculties. This is interesting stuff. Friend, these five faculties each have their separate field, a separate domain, and do not experience each other's field and domain. Excuse me. That is the eye faculty, ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, and body faculty. Now, these five factors each have their separate field, right? You don't see with your tongue. You don't taste with your ear. So it's separate. Each one of these are separate. They have their own function. And separate domain. Not experiencing each other's field and domain. What is their resort? What experiences these fields and domains? Friend, these five faculties each have a separate field and a separate domain and do not experience each other's field and domain. That is the eye faculty, ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, and body faculty. Now, these five faculties, each having a separate field and domain, are not experiencing each other's field and domain. They have mind as their resort. And mind experiences their fields and domains. Right? In order to see, you have good working eye, you have color and form, eye consciousness arises. That's what contact is. Friend, as to these five faculties, that is the eye faculty, ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, and body faculty, stand in dependence on, what do these five faculties stand in dependence on? Friend, as to these five faculties, that is the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body faculty, these five faculties stand in dependence on vitality. Friend, what does vitality stand in dependence on? Vitality stands in dependence on heat. Friend, what does heat stand in dependence on? You're going to love this answer. Heat stands in dependence on vitality. Just now, friend, we understood the Venerable Sariputta to have said vitality stands in dependence on heat. And now we understand him to say heat stands in dependence on vitality. How should the meaning of this statement be regarded? Reasonable question. In that case, friend, I shall give you a simile, for some wise men understand the meaning of a statement by means of a simile. Just as when an oil lamp is burning, its radiance is seen in dependence on its flame, and its flame is seen in dependence on its radiance. Got it? Something is burning. Okay, you have a flame. There's no radiance if there's no flame. And there's no flame if there's no radiance. Do you see? Well, we'll get more into the vitality and heat in a minute. So, okay, its flame is seen depending on its radiance. Okay. Friends, are vital formations things that can be felt, or are vital formations one thing and things that can be felt another? Vital formations are not things that can be felt. If vital formation were things that can be felt, then a person who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness would not be seen to emerge from it, because vital formations are one thing and things that can be felt another. A monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling and consciousness can be seen to emerge from it. Friend, when the body is bereft of how many states, is it then discarded, forsaken, left lying senseless like a log? Friend, when this body is bereft of three things, vitality, heat, and consciousness, it is then discarded and forsaken, left lying senseless like a log. Friend, what is the difference between one who is dead and one who has completed his time, and a person who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness? It's almost like being dead, but there is some difference. Friend, in the case of one who is dead, who has completed his time, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided. His vitality is exhausted. His heat has dissipated, and his faculties are fully broken up in the case of In the case of a person who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided, but his vitality is not exhausted. His heat has not been dissipated, and his faculties become exceptionally clear. So even while they're sitting in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, their face becomes radiant. Very clear. This is the difference between one who is dead, who has completed his time, and a monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. In other words, he still has the vitality of the six senses. It's still there. Still has heat going through his body. So there is some slight beating of the heart. There is some breathing, and you breathe through your skin and your ears, but not through your lungs. So, you have to make a determination to go into this state and stay in this state for up to 7 days. How much time do you have? Well, I got a good weekend, so I'm going to go in for 2 days. In Asia, people get real afraid if they see somebody sitting without breathing. Oh, they're dying. And they really don't like to be around people that are sitting in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness very much. So when they have that ability to do that, they generally go someplace where other people can't see them. Friend, how many conditions are there for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind? Friend, there are four conditions for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a monk enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So when you get to the fourth jhana, I tell you now, you're an advanced meditator. When you get to the fourth jhana, because of your experience with the meditation, you're able to understand a lot of what it says in the suttas. Before that, it can be very confusing. And when people come to the meditation center, if they haven't gotten to the fourth jhana, I don't let them read anything. I want to see the newspaper. No. I want to get on my internet. No. Take that away. You don't need that. When you get to the fourth jhana, you have this balance of mind. And this is where the Buddha praises people about their mind in the fourth jhana. Your mind is wieldy. Your mind is manageable. Your mind is really clear. And you have that equanimity. These are the four conditions for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Now, this is a kind of deliverance of mind, but it is mundane. Not supramundane. Friend, how many conditions are there for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind? That is the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. You don't have any signs, no consciousness. Friend, there are two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. Non-attention to all signs and attention to the signless element. These are the two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. Friend, How many conditions are there for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind? Friend, there are three conditions for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind. Non-attention to all signs, attention to the signless element, and the prior determination of its duration. So you have to make a determination when you're going to get out. And when you start working with the determinations, at the start of the retreat, I said I wanted you to do two things before you went to sleep. One, make a determination to the second of when you get up. And make a determination to wake up smiling and happy, right? Now, the reason that I wanted you to start doing that and do it every night, whether you're on retreat or not, when you start working with waking up at a particular time, you're starting to set your body clock. And you can get quite accurate with it and consistent, but it takes practice. So start now and do it every night, and before long you'll say, well, I've got 2 minutes to do this, and you know that it's 2 minutes when you've got it done. Okay, these are the three conditions for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind. So when you get good at it and your meditation gets good and you can get into the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, then you will be able to, let's say, I'm going to sit for 3 days, 5 hours, 47 minutes, and 3 seconds. And exactly like that, that's when you come out of the cessation. Friend, how many conditions are there for the emergence of the signless deliverance of mind? Friend, there are two conditions for the emergence of the signless deliverance of mind. Attention to all signs and non-attention to the signless element. These are the two conditions for the emergence from the signless deliverance of mind. Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, the signless deliverance of mind. Are these states different in meaning and different in name? Or are they one in meaning and different in name only? Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, the signless deliverance of mind. There is a way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name. And there is a way in which they are one in meaning and different in name only. What, friend, is the way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name? Here a person abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. Does this sound familiar? So above, below, around, and everywhere, as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He abides pervading one quarter of his mind imbued with compassion. And then it goes through all six directions again. He abides pervading one quarter of a mind, of his mind imbued with joy. And he does it six directions again. He abides pervading one quarter of a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere. To all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. This is called the immeasurable deliverance of mind. And that's what I've been showing you. And what, friends, is a deliverance of mind through nothingness? Here, with the complete surmounting of the base of infinite space, aware that there is nothing, a mind enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness. This is called the deliverance of mind through nothingness. And what, friends, is a deliverance of mind through voidness? Here a monk, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or an empty hut, reflects thus. This is void of a self, or of what belongs to a self. This is called the deliverance of mind through voidness. In other words, using this meditation, when I did it for about 6 months, I didn't say it in these words. But when a thought would come up, or a feeling or sensation, whatever it happened to me, my question to myself was, is this me? Is this mine? Is this who I am? And always the answer was, mm-mm. You can get to the seventh jhana by doing this. And it is interesting, because you stop taking your crazy thoughts, your attached thoughts, and you start going, well, did I ask this to come up? Is this me? Is this mine? I don't have any control over it. It arose by itself. It's a real good way to understand the impersonal nature of everything. When you question every thought, every feeling, every sensation, is this me? Did I ask this to come up? It's a way of learning how to let go of the desire to control. So I found it real interesting doing that. But then again, I'm kind of a fanatic when it comes to finding out what it says in the suttas, and I want to see if it's right. I'm going to practice it. There are some practices for monks that they're called dutanga practices. They're extra things that monks can do. They're not quite getting into asceticism, but they're somewhat close. One of the things is only practicing three postures: sitting, standing, walking, not lying down. And I did that for a period of time. And I saw there is an advantage. You actually wind up having more energy when you do that, which doesn't sound right. But there's three levels of doing it. One level is you sit in the middle of the room and you sit and sleep. And what generally happens is before long you start slumping, so you have to wake up again. And then you try to do that for 3 or 4 hours and see what happens. The next level is leaning against a wall. Okay, that's what I did. I leaned against a wall for about 6 months. And the next level is sitting in a chair without any arms and sleeping. Now, I knew a monk from Burma that when he died, I think he was 96 years old. For 76 years, he never lay down. He always just sat in a chair. He was quite a meditator, too. But that's a special kind of practice. Other kinds of practice is only eating what's put in your alms bowl. So if you see something else on the table and you want something, no, you don't do that. You only eat what's given to you. So there's a lot of different kinds of practice that you can do. One of the practices is only sleeping under a tree. And that's a tough practice. It's not real comfortable under trees, if you haven't noticed, for a lot of them. They got roots coming up and all sorts of things. And there's one practice of never being under a tree. And what they did was they took their robes and they made it into a kind of tent with a stick. And then they would go under there and they would sit there. That's how they got out of the direct sun. So there's a lot of different kinds of practices that you can do that are kind of extra special. And I found advantage to do a lot of them, just having three robes. And you have to wear one robe while you wash the other and then dry it and then switch back and forth. It's kind of an interesting practice. Now, the brown robe that I have, I've had that robe for 20 years. It was given to me in 1995. And I'm still using it. It's starting to get kind of skinny. It's starting to get bare thread. And it breaks my heart because I love robes that are very old. They're comfortable. It's like a pair of jeans before they start falling apart. And that takes away the thought or necessity of being attached to certain colors and being attached to different kinds of material and that sort of thing. So it's real interesting. And I've had robes that started out as white, and then I had to dye them. And what we did in the forest was we got the inner bark of the jackfruit tree and boiled it and then boiled the cloth with it And if you do it just right and you do it long enough, you come out with a robe that is really wonderful looking. And it's kind of a glowy orange color. Anytime you see a monk that has one of those, you go, oh man, I wish I had one of those. But the problem is, it only lasts like that for a little while, and you have to re-dye it. And the way that you set the dye is by letting it stay wet and folding it up and putting it in a dark place. And it gets moldy. And the mold is the thing that sets the color. And it's real interesting doing that sort of thing, taking care of yourself that way and not going out and buying something new. You don't need to buy something new. Just take care of what you got. I have I had a spoon. I gave it to a layman and he wanted to wash it and he broke it. That was made out of coconut. When you eat in a bowl, it goes up like that a little bit. Coconut is the perfect roundness so that you can eat. And I had that for, well, 87. I had that for 13 years. A coconut shell. That's what I ate with. So one of the things about being a monk is that you don't want to get caught up too much in obtaining things. People used to give me all kinds of things, paintings and pictures, and I got a lot of robes given to me. And what do I do with my robes? There was one Vesak day that I had over 50 robes given to me. 50 robes. What am I going to do with 50 robes? I got my robe that I've had for 5 years. I don't need that. So I wound up sending it to one of the poor monasteries in Sri Lanka. Don't need a lot of stuff. And it makes life easier when you don't have so much. Sometimes I get invited to some people's houses and they have this idea that it's clean, it's orderly, and it's cluttered. On a table they'll put all kinds of little things. And there's no room to walk around and things like that. And that's one of the things that when the Buddha said, lay life is dusty and crowded. Life as a monk is wide open. I can sleep anywhere. And I do. I'm sleeping in all kinds of different places. And more often than not, I wind up sleeping on the floor because I don't want to sleep in a bed. I do have a mat. Now that I'm getting older, I get stiff a little bit, so I have a mat that I sleep on. But I get the best sleep there. Because I don't have these ideas that things have to be in a particular way in order for me to be comfortable. Don't have that so much. Easy to let things go. Not be attached. People give me something, I accept it with this hand. Find somebody to give it to. When I was The last time I was in Indonesia, there were about 40 robes that were donated. And I have to accept it. I have to accept all those robes. And I had to get a place to store them. And a couple of years ago that happened, and there was some real problems in Bangladesh where the Muslims were going to the monasteries and burning clothes and burning monasteries down and that sort of thing. So as soon as I heard that, I sent 80 ropes, or was it many boxes of robes, and they didn't get to the monks. So I said, let's do it again. I certainly don't need that many monks, that many robes. And we're Sangha. And Sangha, there you don't own things personally. This is for the Sangha. An interesting thing that I want to make clear for you is that when you offer something to me, I don't say thank you very often. Why? Because if I say thank you, then that's a personal gift from one person to another. And I want you to have the most amount of merit you can make when you give something. So don't give it to me personally. Give it to the Sangha with the Buddha at its head. And that's how you make the most merit. So I'm not being rude by not saying anything. Or I might say sadhu, which means well done. Because I want you to have the highest amount of good coming back to you. And in America, people get offended if you don't say thank you when they hand you something. But I don't. And I want people, a lot of people, to start understanding that that is a good thing, by not saying thank you. When you give it with the entire Sangha as your, in your mind. And that means that I can share it with any other monk around. Because it's not a personal gift. I would share personal gifts anyway, but. So it's really kind of interesting. Being a monk is good fun, but it's also, when you first become a monk, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. When you become a monk, you're taking off that thin layer that you have where things that touch you don't bother you so much. And then as you start purifying your mind, somebody can say something and it's very hurtful and it's ow. But you learn to develop your equanimity and acceptance of things without trying to change them. So that makes everybody real anxious to put on the robes, right? But it is good fun. And I have had some of the best Dhamma discussions without ever knowing the name of the person that I was talking to. They just come to a monastery and I was there and we'd sit down and start talking and we might talk for 6 or 8 hours and just be fascinated by what was being said and figuring out how to change the way you see things and just being with somebody that cared enough to tell you the truth. That's remarkable experiences. Good fun. Anyway, okay, we're almost done with the sutta, so. And what, friend, is the signless deliverance of mind? Here, with non-attention to all signs, a person enters upon and abides in the signless collectedness of mind. This is called the signless deliverance of mind. This is the way in which these things are different in meaning and different in name. And what, friend, is a way in which these states are one in meaning and different in name only? Lust is a maker of measurement. Hate is a maker of measurement. Delusion is a maker of measurement. In a person whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so that they are no longer subject to any future arising. Now, this was lust, hatred, delusion. What's another word for that? Craving. I like it. I don't like it. I take it personally. Okay, this is just another way of describing craving. And when you let go of craving, you will become an arahat. Of all the kinds of immeasurable deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now, that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion, void of craving. Lust is a something. Hatred is a something. Delusion is a something. In a monk whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now, that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. Lust is a maker of signs. Hate is a maker of signs. Delusion is a maker of signs. In a monk whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so that they are no longer subject to any future arising. Of all the kinds of signless deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now, that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. This is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different in name only. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The Venerable Mahakohita was satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's word. So, the importance of being able to recognize craving cannot be understated. And the reminder to see it and relax and let it be cannot be stated often enough. It's that important. And when you're able to do that, you will be able to get to a state where you are going to let go of a whole ocean of suffering. That's what meditation is for. That's the main purpose of the Buddha's teaching. Everything he taught was different ways of getting to the same end result, and that is experiencing the coolness of Nibbana. So I've been talking again for a long time. Do you have any questions? You mean I have explained everything so well that you don't have a question? Okay.
When you said a few days ago that consciousness arises 100,000 times in the duration of a snap.
Yeah.
Is this a fundamental number, or is this a...
No. When you get to numbers in Buddhism, they get them screwed up quite a bit. It's just a way of saying a lot. Okay, sometimes people say a million. Well, you got to take it with a grain of salt. And the Burmese, when they were translating and they come to numbers, the translator always makes a mistake. No, it's not 12, it's 8, or whatever. So you take it with just as a kind of simile to give you an idea of how fast these things really are occurring.
One thing you were talking about, the time periods required for different Buddhas to arise.
Yeah. Okay. An asankhaya. No, let's do it this way. A mahakapa has 4 asankhayas. An asankhaya is a period of time when the universe is expanding and then it will stop. And it stops for an asankhaya. And then it contracts for an asankhaya. And then it stops for an asankhaya. An asankhaya, generally speaking, according to Buddhists, and I don't know how good their numbers are with this, but they say it's 1 asankhaya is 10 with 160 zeros behind it. So that's a long time. But the universe is always in a state of flux. It's not, I mean, it's expanding, it stops, it contracts, it stops, but it's always doing that. And that's 1 mahakapa. So 1 mahakapa is 4 asankhayas. And that makes it 10 with 560 zeros behind it. That's a fairly long period of time. And we've been around many, 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 many mahakapas. Being born this close to a Sammasambuddha means that you've done a lot of good stuff in the past. To be born this close is amazing. I mean, his teachings are still reasonably intact. How lucky you are. So there's, according to Letty Sayadaw, he said that the Buddha era that we're in right now is only going to last about 5,000 years. So we're about halfway through that. And then there's going to be a long period of time when there is no idea of Buddhism. And when the world starts suffering enough, people in the world start suffering enough, and they're starting to get awake to the fact that they're really causing themselves pain, then the future Buddha will take a look at the conditions and say, well, okay, I'm gonna get out of the two-seat to heaven, be reborn as a human being. And then he will spread the Dhamma. Now, an interesting thing with Gotama was when he became a bodhisattva, when he made the vow in front of the Sumedho Buddha, he said, I'm going to search and suffer for 6 years to show my determination so people will be inspired by that. Not all Buddhas go through that. Some Buddhas, they just get to a certain age in life and all of a sudden it happens for them. They see it. But there's still the curiosity about the links of dependent origination and having that understanding. So not all of the Buddhas really work as hard as Gotama did. And some of the things that he did in his ascetic practices are really, really disgusting. I'm not going to read it to you from the suttas, but he drank his own urine and ate his own feces until there was no more, thinking that that was a way to become awakened, because that was some of the practices that were happening during that time. He would sleep on thorns and things like that. He would hang from a tree upside down because he thought that might be the way to become enlightened. He starved his body, everybody knows about that one, really a lot. But every practice he did, he went to the end of it and he said, I can do this as a human being this far. Nobody can go further than that without dying. But they can equal what I've done to see whether the Nibbana was attained that way. A lot of people in India especially think foods. If you just eat this food or that food, then you'll become awakened. So he did that to see how it went. And he did things like holding his breath. And you know that partition you have here? Under your tongue? He cut it so he could swallow his tongue and stop breathing through his lungs. And when he did that, the air started going through his ears. And it was really loud. So he started plugging his ears up when he was holding his breath. And then he would have really intense pains, like somebody was, two men were big and strong and they held him over a fire and it was burning his feet up. And that's what it felt like. And he would stop and he would regain a little bit of strength, and then he would say, well, I think I'll try that again, see what happens. And he tortured himself and went to the end of it to see whether, is this work or not? And I, for one, truly am happy that he proved a lot of those things don't work. So I don't have to try them. Yeah.
You mentioned about the 8 different sanghas.
Yeah.
And then can you tell a little bit more about the path and the fruition in the 8 different levels, right? The 4 different
levels? Actually, you're going to have to wait for that. Okay, I'll do that next retreat. There's some suttas in here that are really good, fun suttas that talk about these kind of things. Okay? Yeah.
You had made a comment. I think you said Sariputta attained nirvana while fanning the Buddha.
Yeah.
Was that just an understanding, or did he, like, lose consciousness?
It happened fast.
It happened?
Fast.
So
what happened was, Sariputta, he and Moggallana became Buddhist monks at the same time, and Moggallana became an arahat in 7 days. And Sariputta, it took him 14 days. He was kind of slow. But the reason that that happened was he kept on watching how dependent origination worked, and he was fascinated by it. And when he was fanning the Buddha, now he had the potential to become an arahat really fast. While he was fanning the Buddha was giving a Dhamma talk to somebody else, and Sariputta realized that the Buddha was not even attached to the Dhamma. And he saw that he was. He just had one little tiny attachment. And as soon as he let it go, he had a very quick cessation and attainment with fruition of arahatship in the time that he did this. I read to you how he went through every one of the jhanas, didn't I? But it can happen at any time. I've had some students that have not even gotten to the arupa jhana, and they had the experience of nibbana. Now, in the past, at some point, I'm sure that they did meditation. That's in some lifetimes. They had deep understanding, and they saw how this process worked, and there was no question, and they had that experience with the cessation. Pretty interesting. And pretty impressive to see, yeah, that's how that can happen for anybody that has experienced even the first jhana. You have the potential to attain nibbana. You have that potential now. It's just a matter of using the 6 R's and understanding how this process works. So, you ready for it to happen tonight? Why not? Don't push for it to happen, please. Yeah.
Monty, but isn't waiting for nirvana a craving yet?
Well, I had a Korean man that did a retreat with me, and he was zooming up to neither perception nor non-perception. And he just stopped. He didn't go any deeper. And I didn't actually know what to tell him. So I said, why don't you ask yourself a question? And he was getting angry at me like I was stopping him from attaining Nibbana. And I said, you need to ask yourself, what is making you slow down with your progress? You just ask one time, and this is in the suttas, what is the cause and condition for this arising, or not arising, as the case may be? So he went off and he asked that question, and his intuition came back. And the next day I said, his face looked a lot brighter and he was not so angry at me, like I had some control over it. And he said, I stopped waiting. Okay, waiting is being impatient, right? Who's impatient? Who wants something to happen? Right after that, he did very nicely. So, another thing I want to mention, because a lot of people have a lot of different practices and they go to these different teachers, and the teachers say, well, it's really good to take the bodhisattva vow. You ought to take the bodhisattva vow. That vow is so strong that it stops you from attaining Nibbana. A bodhisattva vow is a vow to become a future Buddha. Now, there's three kinds of Buddha. You know how long they had to work to get to it. If you don't take a bodhisattva vow in front of a Sammasambuddha, and he will look into the future to see whether you have strong enough determination to go through all of the things necessary to become a Buddha, he will tell you, don't take the bodhisattva vow if you can't do it. But these days, a lot of Mahayana, they come up with some ideas about the bodhisattva vow. Oh, you can renounce Nibbana, you can become an arahat, renounce Nibbana, and help all beings. Help all beings to be get off the wheel of samsara. Well, the Buddha couldn't do that. If he could, we wouldn't be here. Right? So why say that sort of thing? It's not true. But when you take a bodhisattva vow, it will stop you from attaining Nibbana. So what I tell people to do is if they've taken a bodhisattva vow, they can renounce the bodhisattva vow. With a solemn mind, you go in front of a Buddha image, and you say three times, I now renounce the bodhisattva vow. I give it up. And if you've taken a bodhisattva vow, you will feel strong relief. Now what happens to most people that take a bodhisattva vow but they don't take it in front of a Buddha to find out if they really can do it or not, is that after a few thousand lifetimes, they start realizing that this is really a difficult path. And then you give up the bodhisattva vow, but you're not in a Buddha era anymore, so you're stuck in samsara. Until you get to be around in another Buddha era. So I don't think that it's skillful to take a bodhisattva vow. Because you go through a lot of suffering, many lifetimes of suffering. And it's really nasty. I mean, there's instances in the Jataka tales where the Buddha, he spent 80,000 mahakapas in the frozen realm. You like being cold? How about 80,000 Mahakapas of it? Yeah.
Okay, so it's possible that in another lifetime that I took that vow?
It is possible. If you don't
I
know.
A lot.
All beings have suffered a lot. But if, did you have a dream when you were kind of a 15-year-old or a teenager like that? Did you have a dream of entering a Buddha?
Entering a Buddha, not that I recall.
You can renounce the Bodhisattva vow, but the way you know that you're taking the Bodhisattva vow is by having a dream like that. Of actually entering in like a little doorway in front of, and through into the Buddha.
I was raised Catholic and I didn't even know what a Buddha was. So.
See, if you've taken the Bodhisattva vow, it doesn't matter whether you think you know what it is, you will have a dream where you will enter into a Buddha.
But the interesting thing was when I took world religions class as a Catholic, I saw the teachings of the Buddhism and I went, this is truth, and I completely was disillusioned.
Okay. You might have been a Buddhist in some past lifetime. But that doesn't necessarily mean you took a Bodhisattva vow. Yes.
They are strongly kind of encouraged to give up Nibbana to, like you say.
Right.
Save all beings.
Save all beings.
But not in Theravada, I think.
No. There are some monks that take a Bodhisattva vow, but they don't advertise it. They don't talk about it at all.
Yeah. That's why they say, like Theravada, the monk only think of themselves, they own Nibbana, and the Mahayana said, oh, we are thinking of saving all beings or something like that.
Yeah, and it's not true.
Okay, yes, right, yeah.
As you purify your mind, you naturally start helping other people and helping them to overcome suffering naturally. And I had some Mahayana people that had practiced Mahayana for a long time, and they came and they saw how much I was giving Dhamma and helping other people and doing things like that. And they said, you're a true Bodhisattva. But I'm not a Bodhisattva. But that's what, it looks like that's what we do at the center. We help everybody that comes along. We do a lot of good things. Yeah.
Okay. I think you're making a really interesting and powerful point, because I think I've met a lot of people who are seriously interested in Buddhism. And it's almost as if they unconsciously have a wish to be a bodhisattva without having really appreciated what the actual corollary of that decision is.
Yeah.
Do you think that there are people who sort of quasi unconsciously commit to being a bodhisattva without really realizing what they're doing?
Absolutely. And that vow is so strong that it will stop you from attaining nibbana.
Yeah.
That's why I tell a lot of people, and I don't care whether you keep a Bodhisattva vow or not. It's up to you. But I give you the opportunity to understand how this really works. And I think that's important so that you can make an informed decision whether you want to stay a Bodhisattva or not. So.
How would you even know if you did it in the past life?
I told you. You have a dream. Well, you enter in, you will enter.
You naturally will have it.
That's right. Yeah.
When in doubt, renounce it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've renounced it at least 10 times, just to make sure.
So when you talked about the snapping and 100,000 consciousness, could you explain a little bit how the other consciousness, like I consciousness,
it all works the same way.
Do they all intermingle, one at a time? How does that work?
The only thing you have to believe in Buddhism, everything happens one thing at a time. That's the only thing you have to believe. And you'll see it for yourself as you go deeper into meditation. So it's not a blind belief. And if you have any doubt as to whether you took a bodhisattva vow or not, renounce. That's okay. It's not a bad thing.
It would be interesting to see if your hit rate of stream entry really jumped after you incorporated doing that unhitching from the bodhisattva thing with every group right at the beginning of your relationship.
I think I need to spend some time educating first. And when people start having more confidence in the teaching of what I'm showing, then I could say it, but it's up to every individual to make that choice for themselves. But one of the things I found with that happened to me in when I went to a Zen retreat was they had me repeating words from another language, and I found out that I was taking a bodhisattva vow, and I didn't know it. Yeah, so I renounced that right straight away, and I told the person that did that, you're not being honest by giving this bodhisattva vow to other people without explaining it. Well, yeah, you have to be serious about it. Not that I know of. Okay. So let's share some merit now. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhus.